proud means to stand out. So if you're pruned,
you know, that means you're falsely pruned.
Ah, falsely
pruned. Yes, that's true.
You're not properly pruned.
Yeah. Falsely pruned means maybe everything else was cut back, so it stands out even more.
Yeah, what should have remained was cut back.
That's more proud. So it is appropriate.
Yes. Hari Om Sahana Vavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Sahaviryam Karavavahai Tejasvinavaditamastu
Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shiva Sari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
Of the two kinds of answers given by the living entities, means of the questions on who am I, you know, what is the universe, what's my relationship, like this. One is the true answer. The other is a great variety of answers according to the views of different philosophies. Okay, I think we did. Footnote 7. Within this world there are countless philosophies which, although attempting to reach the truth, are all incomplete and mutually contradictory because of their origin in bewilderment. Chaitanya Shikshamrita 1.1.
How do we define philosophy?
One. It's just page one. So this is like, it opens with it.
Yeah.
How do we define philosophy? Philosophy is just whatever someone feels is the basis or origin and explain something. It means he's basically talking about who are we, what or why are we here, all these kind of things.
Because it seems that they're not really real philosophies.
No, because there's only one true answer. Yes. Everything else is here he's talking is just because people will call them philosophy. Mm. So you say there's countless philosophy. But in actuality, they're all, because it's all starting in bewilderment, so they're not actual philosophers like that. The great variety of answers may be divided into two groups. The first group is called jnana, and the second group is called karma. Right? So that's important, is that this is all that's being represented. If it's not proper Vaishnavism, it's only representing karma and jnana. Mm. There isn't something else. Mm. Right? It's not that, well, they're almost spiritualist. No, they're material. Mm. Just as the spiritual side of material. Right? In other words, material is consciousness. So even if someone is situated in Brahman, if his consciousness is not in the, you know, connected with the personality of Godhead, then he's absorbed in the mundane. Right? So then Maya's reach is out to even the Brahman. Right? Like that. But for those who understand the personality of Godhead and serve Him, then that situation in Brahman, they're actually situated in serving Krishna. Mm. Does that make sense? So Brahman just means the transcendental position. So one can be transcendental, means transcendentally situated with mundane consciousness, or transcendentally situated with transcendental consciousness. Right? Does that make sense? So those with spiritual forms, they're established in transcendental consciousness. Those without, right, then they are still with the mundane. So that's why we say technically they're not liberated, right, because they'll come back. Here, someone may protest. When you say the true, yukta, answer, you imply that you honor logic, yukti, as the way to know the truth. Why, then, do you not accept the great variety of answers that logic brings? Right? If you're saying is that you accept the truth, so then why aren't we, and so therefore, and that truth, are using the word yukta, so therefore you arrive at truth through yukti, through logic, so why not you accept all the philosophies that logic can come up with? Right? Because logically you could do this, you could do that, you could do so many things. You know, it's just like I'm cooking. I can put the pot this way, I can put it sideways, I can put it upside down, I can put it on this edge, I can spin it, you know, like that. You know, I can do so many things with it. You know, I can take two of them and bang them together. I mean, they can go on and on and on what you can do. But in reality, you know, there's anybody who's a cook, there's one way they do it. Right? They don't do it another way. But those who aren't actually cooks, they can come up with a million ways to do something like that. Yes.
Maharaj, in this connection, like we spoke of the last few days about the three states of object and the Dharma being dormant. If you take Sanatana Dharma as being dormant in the heart of living entity, and then being evident when the manifested as Varnashram, first one as Nitya, then Naimittik, and then it's perverted to as Anitya. Can we see it in that way? That the Sanatana Dharma can fully manifest when it's reflected in the form of Varnashram?
Well, it's not Varnashram that makes Nitya Dharma. Nitya Dharma is when it's connected to the Lord. Right? So that, therefore, the term Nitya activities are only actually Nitya if they're connected to the Lord. Because otherwise, then you have Nitya also just means the regular. Right? What you always do. And naimittik means what you occasionally do. So then, for the Brahman or for anybody, what is their daily duties? That would be their nitya dharma. Right? The kshatriya every day, you know, takes his bath, does his puja, he goes to the, you know, sees the Brahman, sees the gods, sees the saint, then goes to court. That's his nitya dharma. But it's still within the mundane. So when we say Sanatan, Nitya means what is connected with the Lord. And Anitya means what's connected to that which is temporary, the material. You understand? That's the spiritual way of looking at it. If you're simply looking at the mundane, then you will say, you know, this is Nitya, this is like that. It means what's regular for as long as you're in your body. But it'll change. That's why we say it's Anitya. Because the soul now is doing the kshatriya duties, but next life they may not be, last life they may not have been. Does that make sense? So you have to define, it's not the term, it's how the term's applied. You know what I'm saying? It means the weather is cool, right? But the guy in the fancy suit and all that, he's also cool. Does that mean if you go up and touch them, you know, you get some, you know, your finger gets some, you know, frostbite or something? you know what I'm saying? So you have to know the context. It's not just the word. So, in other words, understand nitya means that it always goes on. Naimittik means it's occasional or temporary. So then, whether you're looking at it from that spiritual platform or whether you're looking at it within the material platform. Does that make sense? So then it's applied. You know, it's just like you go. It means the cook is cooking, but also the what do you call it? Accountant, when he's dealing with the accounts at the end of the year before they go to the authorities, he cooks the accounts. That's the term they use, right? They say, you know, wow, these need to be cooked. Right? Means, you know, it's not, you know. You know, and when somebody is considered, you know, very mature and all that, they don't, it means then it's called siddha, which means cooked. You know, it means it's he's not raw, he's not kacha. You know, he's not like a baby, it's mature. You understand? So, does that make sense? You know, and if you ask a teenager, you know, anything more than, you know, 29 seconds is eternal. Right? You know, so therefore also you have Does that make sense? So you have to know the context. So in other words, learn the words, learn the meanings, but learn what's the principle behind it so you know how to apply it in all these different situations. Otherwise, just knowing the words, it means that's a first step. At least that means you have a memory, you know. But then the next thing is to actually understand what it means. Okay? Okay. To this protest, I reply, spiritual logic does not depend on the material logic that brings a variety of answers. Therefore, when I use the words logic, yukti, and truth, yukta, I refer to the logic and truth accepted by liberated souls, purified of matter's touch. Logic and truth that properly distinguish between matter and spirit, right? Because that's what the Bhagavatam is saying. You know, is that we're using this discrimination to be able to define what's spiritual and what's material, right? And what's the difference? Logic that is material, that takes shelter of matter, will always lead to a great variety of conclusions. A liberated soul situated in his original spiritual form can give the true, the genuine logical answer. Right? So also we have here is when you're talking about Dharma, when Dharma is applied to the spiritual, which is the nature of the soul, then it has its natural, what do you call it? What's that word he uses? You have dormant?
Manifest?
No.
Evident.
Yeah, then it's in its natural state. That evident, you can see it's there. And but in the material, the same Dharma is applied, it becomes perverted. Right? Is that make sense? Right? So, therefore, like in the example of the fire, you still say, you know, instead of saying it's burning, you say it's smoldering. You know, or instead of saying it's a nice fire, it's just a flash fire. Mm-hmm. Right? So the heat and light was there, but no burning power. Just gone. It won't do anything.
Because material is within dualism, and therefore it moves.
Yes, it's always changing. I mean, there's always these extremes. Right? Yeah. Yeah. So therefore, there's the natural position, so then these liberated souls, they always give the same answer. But when you come, take that same logic and apply it within the material, then you come up with all kinds, because there's the modes of nature. Spiritual world is no modes of nature. Yes?
Since the philosophy is one, what is the variety of spoken of by different munis? Like each muni is defined by his own philosophy.
You'd have to see. Is Narad Muni, then he's in the class of the one true answer. Others, then you have to see. Vyasa Muni is also. But, you know, Charvak is not. You know what I'm saying? Then they come up with their own. It just means they have their own presentation, very nice. Like Madhvacharya, he's Madhva Muni. Right, because it's different, it's unique. Does that make sense?
So the difference doesn't lie.
It means the philosophy is unlimited. So within the one true answer, there's so many aspects, you can emphasize one aspect or another. Just like you see some devotees are saying, you know, how the chanting is important, someone else says it's kirtan, someone else says it's association, you know, someone else say book distribution, someone else is, you know, surrendering, like this. They're all correct. It's just which aspect they are emphasizing of the one truth. But when you drop it from the spiritual platform, those all become completely different philosophies. Right? Because the one, they're an aspect of the bigger complete. The other one, they're just a portion, but they're trying to keep it, say that that portion is complete. Right?
Okay.
Does that make sense? Yes.
A philosopher who is under the modes which covered, for him to accept the absolute truth, he can't see because he's covered.
No.
So he will actually deny the absolute truth.
He'll deny unless he has the association of the pure devotees, and then he may be able to see. And so by their association, then he's seeing from that platform beyond the modes, right? From the platform of the soul. But if they try to see through their own logic, it won't work, right? Does that make sense? We can logically present you know, the position of God and all that. But the point is you won't actually understand except by God's grace. You know what I'm saying? Because even someone, if he doesn't have God's grace, even it's logically presented, he won't appreciate it. Because by that same logic, then you can turn everything around and turn it upside down. That's just what they do, right? Mm-hmm. It means we've seen the last so many days is that whatever you say, there's an exception. Because you can only give a material example, you know, or you can only relate it to the situation that we're in, which is controlled by time and space, right? But the active principle is that association of devotees, that transcendental potency. That's the actual point that's going on. But it's coming through so many mediums. Right? Does that make sense? So the thing is then if you're looking at the medium and try to analyze it according to its mundane position, then you can find all kinds of faults in anything. Right? Because we're giving the example of the moon, but the discussion is not about the moon at all. Mm-hmm. Excuse me, it's the other way. It means the branch of the tree. It's not about the branch of the tree. It's just what's close enough to where the moon is situated on the horizon that if I say, you see that tree? And you can see the tree. Now he's up there on the top there. There's that round object. That's the moon. The discussion is about the moon, not about the tree or the proximity to the tree. You know? Does that make sense? But then people get into the tree. So, you know, that's close to the tree. It's coming up from the tree. So does that mean the moon comes from the tree? And all this kind of stuff, you can go on and on and on and on. Because that seems logical. But that's the problem. It's a variety of logic because the logic's being applied on the material energy through the modes of nature. So it appears to be logical, but it's not actually.
That's the perverted.
Yeah, yeah. So we have to be very careful, right? Because it's not about that logical understanding, it's understanding how to apply it. How does it apply to me? Because self-realization means yourself. It's not just, if I intellectualize on it, then I'll understand it, then I'm self-realized. No, when you can understand it and apply it, then you become self-realized. So that's why submissive inquiry means inquiring how to apply this. Mm-hmm. You know, does that make sense? Yeah. Not just saying, oh, okay, that's what I do. So how do you apply that? You know, not like that. It means you've thought about it and what part you can't apply, that's what you ask about.
What kind of tree was it?
Yeah. Like that. Did it grow naturally or was it planted? You know, like that. And, you know, that's that kind of stuff, yeah. Among the great variety of answers is seen the group called Gyan. Employing Gyan, the spirit soul in contact with matter, tries to distinguish spirit from matter. When it speaks positively, anvaya, Gyana affirms the primacy of matter, saying matter is the beginningless root of all that exists. Right? Because remember is that all material philosophies will be rooted in the material. They don't actually see the spiritual for what it is. Though Gyan is trying to distinguish matter from spirit, they never actually do because they think spirit is what's beyond what can be perceived by the senses, which is correct. But therefore, it doesn't have any qualities. So that's where it runs into a problem. All right? So therefore, then the idea is that everything's coming from matter. And the karma, of course, it comes from matter because you work with matter, you get the result in matter, right? And the other one is you're trying to get out of matter, so anything that you perceive of here has come from matter. So therefore, I'm conscious, that's come from matter, right? The concept of the soul has come from matter, identities come from matter, rasas come from, that's their idea. So you can see is that's why they're material philosophies, karma and gyan, because for them, everything's from matter. So spiritual, that's different than everything's from the Lord. Mm. Right? So that's where all Vaishnavas will be saying the same thing. Mm. Right? So that's what you have to be careful is that when you have the various Vaishnava sampradayas, they're all saying the same thing is that the jiva is the eternal servant of God. But which aspect of that they're bringing out, that will be different. Right? Yes.
So in this way, we also see how atheists, they are always bickering and argue amongst themselves. They can't agree on anything because...
It means the only thing they can agree is if they find a theist, then they'll all bandy together to, like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But once they've gotten rid of him, then they got to spend the rest of the time harassing each other.
Yeah.
Your atheism is not as atheistic as my atheism.
Pure atheism.
Yes. Mine's pure unalloyed atheism. No, but mine's really pure unalloyed atheism. Mine's really, really pure unalloyed. Okay. Oh, I see. At the bottom of this page. Oh, no, we have so much. No, it's all right. Oops, does that go there? Oh, yeah, this does. Okay. Okay, when it speaks positively, Anvaya, Jnana affirms the primacy of matter, saying matter is the beginningless root of all that exists. When it speaks negatively, Vyatireka, Jnana says that matter cannot be destroyed, for it is merely a transformation of the Supreme Brahman, who has no potencies, Nishakti. So footnote 8. Anvaya Vyatirekabhyam Yatsyat Saravatra Saravada. A person who is searching after the Supreme Absolute Truth, the personality of Godhead, must certainly search for it up to this, in all circumstances, in all space and time, and both directly and indirectly. They who follow karma say God does not exist, and therefore the living entity should engage in material activities. Pure jnana and karma have their place in true spiritual love and spiritual activities. They are part of the true answers to our three questions, right? Pure jnana means pure knowledge about the Lord, pure karma, pure activities in connection with the Lord, right? So all it is it's been applied through the wrong object. It means, in other words, the living entity is applying its consciousness and need for interaction, need for happiness on the material energy. The material energy is the object. So you've taken the nature of the soul and manifesting it through the material energy. Therefore, it becomes perverted. Mm-hmm. Right? Or if it's applied in the spiritual world, that's its natural place. So therefore, you know, one can see the natural dharma of the soul.
Mm-hmm.
They will be discussed later in this book, when devotional service, bhakti, will be described. Because they are material in nature, words cannot completely describe the pure spiritual truth. Right? But the point is they can't describe, so it's a matter of pleasing the Lord and His blessing. Then that understanding can come through these words. Right? But the words themselves actually can't describe it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? It means someone has a very intense experience in the material world. He has no words to explain it.
Mm.
So, therefore, the platform of Brahman is way beyond that, and the platform of pure devotional service is unlimitedly beyond that.
Mm.
So, where are the words? There aren't any. But you have words that you use that then are the medium through which the spiritual potency can be exchanged, so one is able to appreciate it.
Mm.
Does that make sense?
Chit Shakti?
Yes, the Chit Shakti. Right. Does that make sense? Right. So that's what once. So it's not the words, it's not the logic, it's not all those things that it's understanding. It's that it's connected to the Lord. That's how you understand. So by the Lord's mercy, you can understand. Yes.
Or is that a sound? Is how the Lord has arranged for some of the prisoners to be taken out of the material world without disturbing the other prisoners?
Well, sometimes the other prisoners get disturbed by the sound. They don't like, you know, Hari Katha or Hari Nam or like this. No, it's just a matter of communication is what living entities do, right? So therefore, one of the ways of communication is through words. So if they're connected to the Lord, it's perfect. They're not connected to the Lord, it's material, right? So therefore, words that are not connected to the Lord cannot describe the Lord. The words connected to the Lord, the words themselves can't describe, but they're able to carry that chit potency by which one can understand. Is that? Okay, text 4. Chittaram bahu vidham vidhi yuktam ekam sarupata. Chittaram adau tata chante yuktam eva vivichyate. Please know that there are a great variety of answers. And there's also one true answer. First, we will consider the great variety of answers, and then we will consider the one true answer. In other words, the first part of the book will deal with the variety of answers. And once that's all been cleared, then one will be able to appreciate the one true answer, which is the second part of the book that just talks about how it would be described from the spiritual platform. Text 5. Atma tava jaram sarvam.
Oh, sorry, there's a mistake. Next, we continue. It'll continue down there. There's a vritti on it.
There is one on 4.
No vritti on 4. No per word.
So,
where does the
vritti
fit?
The vritti is on verse 4.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But verse 5 is just a mistake. It'll continue on.
That will just go on to 6.
Yeah.
Okay. So now, okay. Vritti. If the whole stock of Hindu theological works which precede the Bhagavata were burnt, like the Alexandrian library, and the sacred Bhagavata preserved as it is, not a part of the philosophy of the Hindus, except that of the atheistic sects, would be lost. The Bhagavata therefore may be stylized both as a religious work and a compendium of all Hindu history and philosophy. The Bhagavata, page 14. Okay. Alexandria is that place up in North Africa?
Yeah, in Egypt.
Okay, in Egypt. That's the famous one. Okay. The consciousness of the soul becomes polluted by the material atmosphere, and thus various activities are exhibited in the false ego of bodily identification. These various activities are described in Bhagavad Gita 2.41 as Bahushaka Hinantascha Buddhayo Vyavasayinam. The intelligence of those who are irresolute is many-branched. The conditioned soul is bewildered into various activities for want of pure Krishna consciousness. In pure consciousness, the activity is one. The consciousness of the individual soul becomes one with the supreme consciousness when there is complete synthesis between the two. Right, so he's pointing out is that when it's conditioned, you'll get a variety, right? Because there's so many perspectives. In the spiritual platform, in principle, there's only one, right? But there's variety within that one principle, right? So it's properly connected. But the other one, actually, they think there's different principles. So they come up with so many different ideas that don't connect with each other. Right? Okay. It is foolish to try to stop the activities of consciousness, but they can be purified when they are dovetailed with the Supreme. This consciousness is divided into three modes of self-identification according to the proportion of purity: adhyatmika, or self-identification with the body and mind; adibhautika, or self-identification with the material products; and adidaiva, or self-identification as a servant of the Lord. Of the three, adidaiva, self-identification, is the beginning of purity of consciousness in pursuance of the desire of the Lord. Srimad Bhagavatam 3.6.7 purport. This is adiatmika, adidaivika, adibhautika, used, basically applied to everything. So whenever they're talking about creation, then these discussions will come up. Right. So it's a very, very important. Okay. Text 5. Atma tava. Oh, we just read that. Atma tava jaram sarvam. Swabhavad di pravartate. Svabhavo vidyate nityam. Isha jnanam nivartakam. Some philosophers say that matter is everything. Matter is self-manifest. Matter is eternal. And any concept of God is a senseless lie. Footnote 1. They say that this world is unreal, with no foundation, no God in control. They say it is produced of sex, desire, and has no cause other than lust. Bhagavad Gita 16:8. Now, because otherwise, why is everybody doing everything? So it's based on that element of lust, right? You want something. That's why the endeavor. That's what the whole social system, the whole economic system, everything that's there is simply based on lust, to enjoy, right? Yes.
And also, according to Darwinian theory, it's that urge to procreate, the urge to reproduce one's genes into the pool. That's like the main drive behind modern Darwinism.
Hmm. Right. But the thing is the one-cell living entity was doing quite fine with that. You know, he does it, you know, more efficiently, quicker than anybody else. So how does he define that? Why would they go for a less efficient system? Right, every cell, it splits nicely into two, like that. The people all the time are having trouble having kids. So how is that, you know, succeeding, right? Right? Does that make sense? And you get too many of these little one-celled things inside your body, then you die. You know, so it seems to be a much superior system. You know, it maintains easier, it procreates easier. So why would it decide that, you know, he wants to drive around in a Ferrari, you know. So, you know, one cell is saying, you know, I was thinking it'd be cool, the Ferrari, and that says, yeah, well, you know, but, you know, that's not going to happen. That's, you know, so many, you know, hundreds of millions of years from now, it'll take you to get to that, you know. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't exactly happen like that. So.
I understand what lust means, because sometimes it's applied to, you know, like what, like sex desire, but then other times it seems to be applied to something else, like really far removed, like what you're saying, you want things. So what's that got to do with sex desire?
What are you going to do with it? You want the thing, but it's just adding to your that life.
Okay.
Means, okay, the guy's interested in, you know, some interaction, okay? So, you know, basically he just, you know, gets off the couch, you know, he's got his boxers on and he's got his t-shirt on and, you know, he walks out the door and it's all going to happen, right? Or does he need some good clothes? He needs a good, you know, good wheels. He needs some cash in his pocket. You know, he's got to, you know, he has to have some education, be able to speak on a level that is within the realm, social level that he wants to function at.
Okay.
You understand? It all goes back to there. But in general, lust means the desire to enjoy the results of your endeavor.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, that's the general meaning.
Okay.
But generally, everybody takes that at the end of the line back to the sexual element.
Okay, but it's all the same thing.
Basically.
Okay, so what? Can you just repeat that again? What the meaning is?
It means the general meaning.
Yeah.
It means that you perform an activity, the result, you get a result of that activity, right? So I want to enjoy that result. That's lust. When that result is for Krishna, then that's renunciation, that's sacrifice.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, in Vedic philosophies, will it be karma mimamsa, this description?
I mean, basically there, that's the most complete but you have so many others, is that they're not so worried about. It means if things are happening on the material platform, that's where their absorption, they're not really worried about God, don't really want to be bothered by that. You ruin everything by bringing up God.
Can you really say it is a philosophy?
They think it's a philosophy, so, it goes into the book as philosophy. It's just like, is an ambassador actually a car? You know what I'm saying? But, people will call it if you say, what's that? Oh, it's a car. So that's the thing. The whole material world actually isn't real life, real relationship, real interaction, right? It's only when it's connected to God, then it is. But because it's like the reflection, you call it that. Like in the mirror, you'll say, that's the arm, that's the head, like that. But it's not a real arm and a real head. But that's how it's identified, so that's how we can discuss and relate, so we, like that.
I heard sex desire is perverted because all the souls, they're all related, and they're all female. So,
if you want to get into that, then you can, but the whole point is that that love is connected to Krishna. And so then the sexual energy has a particular purpose in that service. So if it's seen in that way, it takes on a different quality. When you're looking at it as far as enjoyment, then it's always a problem. Does that make sense? Yeah.
So we're not saying that all grihasthas are lesbians.
Not socially, no. If you want to get into tattva, then kind of that's what you're indicating. Right? But you want to know the best part about it?
Yeah.
They're both in the masculine position.
That's funny.
I don't know if you can use that word these days. You might get a shoe thrown at you or something. Run over by a Harley or something. Something may happen. So I'm not sure what's the exact technical term for the masculine aspect of the female, homosexual relationship. I'm not sure. I'm sure there is a technical term, but like that. But I don't. Means before, yes, you could say dyke, but now that's kind of, I think, went out in the 80s. Yeah, you can't say that nowadays. So unless you know good martial arts or how to run fast, don't use it. Because there's a good chance if the lady is one, then she knows how to, kick you in the head or something. Yes. Yeah, so that's why in the material world, you look at it in connection with Krishna, and then it works nice. Oh, okay, there's an ant. He had some notes on there, and this ant went where the lines are. He went, and it turned it from scribbles into an om sign. And then the ant moved, and it went back to scribbles. And I was watching it transform. I said, wow, that's interesting. Wow. Didn't know that,
Artists?
No, that, or he just didn't mind hanging out with the muggles. Okay. The demoniac conclude that the world is phantasmagoria. There's no cause and effect, no controller, no purpose. Everything is unreal. They say that this cosmic manifestation arises due to chance material actions and reactions. They do not think that the world was created by God for a certain purpose. They have their own theory, and that the world has come about in its own way, and that there's no reason to believe that there is a God behind it. For them, there's no difference between spirit and matter, and they do not accept the Supreme Spirit. Everything is matter only, and the whole cosmos is supposed to be a mass of ignorance. According to them, everything is void, and whatever manifestation exists is due to our ignorance in perception. They take it for granted that all manifestation of diversity is the display of ignorance, just as in a dream we may create so many things which actually have no existence. Then when we are awake, we shall see that everything is simply a dream. But factually, although the demons say that life is a dream, they are very expert in enjoying this dream. Right? You know, all this is being said at your little cafe, you know, with your, like that. And so, instead of acquiring knowledge, they become more and more implicated in their dreamland. Right? Because they say all these things. It's not real, there's no cause, there's no effect, there's no meaning, there's no everything, but they're really, really interested and dedicated to enjoying it, even though it has no purpose. You know, the main point about saying it like that is that there's no God, so therefore I can do whatever I want. That's the bottom line. Right? They say all that, they don't understand, it undermines their whole idea to enjoy. But the main thing is if you get rid of any other controller, then whatever I do, I mean, then I'm the controller. Mm-hmm. And since it's just chance anyway, then whatever I whimsically want to do, that's okay. Yeah. That's the whole point. So that's the reason on the materialistic platform that one, the tendency is to ignore or get rid of authority. I mean, of course, you establish yourself as an authority, right? They conclude that as a child is simply the result of sexual intercourse between man and woman, this world is born without any soul. For them, it is only a combination of matter that has produced the living entities. There's no question of the existence of the soul, because if there's no soul, you don't actually have to worry about spiritual. So whatever the body's engaged in doesn't matter, because it's all chance anyway. It's just matter with matter, you know? But the point is they're very specific about what matter with what matter. You can't, you know, hand them a brick and say, hey, enjoy. You know, it doesn't work like that, you know. As many living creatures come out from perspiration and from a dead body without any cause, the whole living world has come out of the material combinations of the cosmic manifestation. Therefore, material nature is the cause of this manifestation. There is no other cause. They do not believe in the words of Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita. Mayad yakshena prakriti suyate sa chara charam. Quote, under my direction the whole material world is moving, end quote. In other words, among the demons there is no perfect knowledge of the creation of the world. Every one of them has some particular theory of his own. According to them, one interpretation of the scriptures is as good as another, as long as they're talking about their own. You know, everybody else's, of course, is stupid. Only my one really makes sense. But, you know, but as soon as you present something actually from the scriptures, then they'll say no, but they're all the same. You understand? You see, they always use it to their advantage. There's never such thing as trying to find the absolute truth. It's all about how to control and enjoy matter however I whimsically like. Right? As long as you don't get in the way of my doing it. So therefore, it seems sophisticated. They get together, they have discussions and meetings to work out how it'll work. Okay, I have this piece of land. Why I have this piece of land? It's no, you know, it's just because I want it. Okay? And so therefore, because I want it, you know, but, you know, okay, I can accommodate that you also want, and your piece of land happens to be next to mine. So therefore, what I say is mine and what you say is yours, we'll agree to that there's a boundary there, and I don't, you know, do things on your side that you don't like, you don't do things on my side. You know? Does that make sense? You know, and then if we want to put up a fence, then that's okay, and then, you know, which side of the fence is that? Who takes care of which fence? You know, all these things are gradually worked out. Does that make sense? So all it is the more this becomes sophisticated, the more it seems like its own reality, very developed and all that. But the bottom line is simply, I want to enjoy however I want to enjoy, and no one should bother me. That's the bottom line. But it seems very sophisticated, very noble, all those kind of things like that. You know, it's just like rich person doesn't want to feel bad. The point is they're living in luxury in that. It bothers them that someone else is not, and so it makes it hard for them to enjoy. Mm. Does that make sense? So if I've given charity, then it's okay. Like I've taken care of, you know, some of these kids in this little village. But even though there's still millions of other kids who are suffering, but it's okay. Right? No, we're not talking about the point that, yes, you're supposed to give in charity and this and that. That's what the Shastra is saying. But the basis of all this is not necessarily that they're just good people. It's that they're sensitive that they can't enjoy if others are having a problem. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So it's, though it's extended, you know, well-meaning, it's still about themselves. Mm-hmm. So that's the difficulty with this. It can appear to be very sophisticated and developed. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? Like, you know, you have the Magna Carta. But is the Magna Carta actually about how to govern people? How to create a proper society? Or it's just so governance doesn't bother the people? You understand? So that's the thing. What is it? There's a thing was done in the mid or late 40s, the International Bill of Rights or something like that. Is that what it's called?
Universal Declaration of Human Rights?
Yeah. But where's the Universal Declaration of Human Obligation? It's not there. It's only what are the rights? So that's the thing. So the point is who's the authority? Who's defined? They are simply saying these are our rights. So whoever's the top of that. So that means if they have the rights, then that means there's obligation. So who is that? This is the international. All these countries get together. So who is the authority that's establishing obligation? Because it's not them. Right?
They don't even.
Does that make sense? You know, it's like if you have a what do you call it? Labor union. Mm-hmm. Right? They're in the junior position. Then the business is in the senior position. Right? So if they're establishing the, you know, Bill of Rights, then, or what do you call it? Declaration of Rights. Mm-hmm. Then the thing is who's establishing the obligations? Mm-hmm. Understand?
Yeah. They don't even follow these rules. It's just a political.
It was just done. It's nice. It means, what do you think first ladies do? They have to do something, right?
Yeah.
It means the West Wing is for all the politics and this and that, and the East Wing is for, you know, being nice. Yeah. So it's, you know, supposed to balance out. Okay. So after a big war and all this, and where you have all the, you know, the tyranny and all that, so then. It sounds good. You know, and after that, and everyone's kind of forgotten, got back to that, then, you know, then nobody worries about it. Like this point, it's hardly anybody even knows they exist. Yes?
In Shastra, they point that you should give charity.
Yes, yes.
But the point of giving charity is, what's the point?
The point in giving charity is that ultimately is the living entity, means the principle of sharing, right? It means that's where you see the better qualities of the feminine natures and sharing. You get something, you share it, right? So the idea is, the ultimate point is everything is shared with God and the devotees. But at least you're getting the principle of that sharing. Because if you can do that in charity, then you would also, you know, should be doing that with family, with friends. You know, you'd be able to appreciate in Krishna consciousness, you know, everything being shared with the Lord and the devotees. So it just makes a basis for that. Does that make sense? So that's why all these Vedic principles are there, to establish the quality that's actually used in Krishna consciousness. You know what I'm saying? It's just like, you know, you have proper grammar and proper poetics and all that. So that means if you have poetics, you would generally say something nice. You know, does that mean that, you know? I mean, that may be an older kind of concept. You know? Yeah, like that. And so the idea was that, you know, you speak nicely, you speak properly. It's exact. People know what you're talking about. It's clear. So then everything works smoothly. But in the spiritual world, then it's based on that. It's based on the absolute truth, you know, and it's nicely said. So everything goes back to the spiritual world. But the idea is that the Vedic culture is that is there to facilitate the devotees in the natural culture that they would be practicing in Krishna consciousness. But even if they're not devotees, at least the culture is there in which devotees can follow. Does that make sense? You know, all the facilities, all the activities, everything that's there is what devotees do. So even though the karmis are doing that, just like it's here, the yoga studio, they all go, they have kirtan. Therefore, if we're going to go there and do a kirtan, everybody, yeah, that's cool. Not what's that, and that's strange, and, you know, stuff like that. You know, it's just like this. Before you go to the yoga studio, everyone avoids Hare Krishna. They chant this, that, and so many other things to kind of stay out of the way. But now that the yogis are all coming and chanting Hare Krishna, oh, now we can chant it, right? You know, it's like that. Does that make sense? So that's why in the Vedic culture, all the things we're supposed to be doing, they're doing. But they're doing it for a material purpose. But at least then the culture's right that if you're doing these activities you consider are mundane, but then you happen to get the association of pure devotees, then you get converted from the material path to the spiritual. Does that make sense? But the problem is people get distracted because the Vedic culture establishes everything nice, so they get conditioned by goodness, and they think, what's the need for the spiritual? That's the problem. Right? It means if you don't have the culture, then people suffer. Right? They have Krishna consciousness, but they suffer. The other one, you have the culture, but then there's a chance you'll be happy with the culture, forget the philosophy. You know? So that's why there has to be the balance. So you have the culture, you have the philosophy.
The culture is what happens in India. In India, they have the culture, but they sometimes lose the philosophy.
Yeah. It means that the great sages and that are based here. They follow the culture. Then it just happens to be in this tract of land that they call India. But for Bharat means the whole planet. The whole universe follows it. So it's just, oh, that's India. So Indra's place you call India? You know what I'm saying? Brahma's place you call India? You know what I'm saying? The whole universe is all India. But if it is, then at least if you're going to say that, India means it takes up the whole universe. So at least then it should be given a little bit more weight. But the point is Vedic is Vedic, whether you call it India, Bharat, or, you know, whatever you want to call it. It doesn't matter. Vedic means it's followed in the universe. Right? But we forget that. We think it's just that all there is this little tract of land here. Like that. Is that okay? Yes.
And they don't share it, then they're a miser.
Yes.
Like that. So, in regards to giving charity or your sharing principle of sharing,
mm-hmm.
what if somebody has like a gift or a talent or something like that, and they're also not sharing it? Is it the same principle, like, of not giving it for others in the benefit of Krishna consciousness, like as a service and?
But it also has to be in the area of that it belongs with sharing, you know, and it has the nature of, like, the person has an occupation, makes money, so then there's the element of sharing, but let's say his capital investment, that's not shared.
Is that meaning there's an obligation with capital investment?
No, but the capital investment is for the business. That's not the part you share. You share profit. You know what I'm saying? Or just like your family is there. You don't. It means in social events they come, they behave nice, they interact. That's the sharing part. It's not that you can take that guy's kid home because not. And when they says, "What's wrong? Well, you can't share? You're such a miser. You got so many kids, you know, like that." You understand? So it also then comes down to you have to be very careful. Is that we're not applying our own idea of what sharing means. We have to see that it's not that we have a particular motive and therefore we'll come use that as the... Does that make sense?
Use that as
the way to get done what we want.
So then are we considered like misers if, say, like God has given us a certain gift or a certain talent or way of doing something and then not sharing it?
But it depends. It has to be something shareable.
Share, like...
It has to be you know what I'm saying? Unless you're an Eskimo, you don't share your wife. You understand? So the thing is it has to be something shareable.
What defines shareable?
That's what the Shastras do. Let's say the girl is good at dancing, but the point is that doesn't mean she does public dancing.
say something like Bhaktiam.
But the point is generally speaking, girls don't do public dancing. Does that make sense? I mean, girls do, but it means girls in certain families don't do. You know what I'm saying?
There's some public dancing that's shareable for Krishna. So is that considered?
Means we don't know if you want to go there. Means it's just like this. Feminine nature freely shared in a controlled way in public, that's called a society girl. But it's also a concept that's foreign to the first world. Other parts, they have an understanding of this like this. Does that make sense? Like in Japan, you have the geishas, right? The main thing about it is the femininity. The high-end ones, the sex is not the point there. It's their ability, some of them, especially when you get over like in China, some of the, just how they can serve the tea. People will pay big bucks for that. Just they'll come, sit, make the tea, serve the tea. It's just done with such feminine perfection and the skill. That's what is looking for. In the West, you don't really have that. It's kind of like you stick the cigarette there, and when it burns out, then time's up. Does that make sense? Right? But in the Vedas, that's considered the lowest end of this. So the ones that you hear about in the Bhagavatam that are coming out, greeting Krishna, bringing the garlands, doing all the social things, lighting the lamps, all there in public, those are the society girls. Those are the high end. But you can't ask a man that his wife should do that. It's like nobody has the right to do that. I mean, nobody. The king can't ask, nobody. He's a simple, just guy in the kingdom. He's, let's say, just a little guy. Let's say he's a carpenter. The king can't say, your wife has to come and do this. It's not allowed. He doesn't have the authority. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So therefore, in tradition, then in the families where the girls are growing up in this culture, then they may learn the dancing, but they never dance in public. They may dance privately amongst family members, but never in public. They just don't do it. Like in South, every girl from a cultured family knows Bharatanatyam, but you'll never see them dancing in public. A few of them do. And it's accepted because it's not a problem that girls, if they want to dance in public, hey, no, nobody minds. It's cool. You know what I'm saying?
I guess I'm thinking if they have that talent and using it in Krishna's service, I guess.
You miss the cultural element. It's still, a girl from a cultured family would never do it. Not publicly.
But taking culture aside.
But you can't take culture aside. When you take culture aside, you end up with a... You understand? So therefore, the first generation that basically dancing in public is, you know, with their clothes on is good. You know, that's a step up. Then it doesn't matter because that's the culture that they're used to. But when you start getting the second and third generation, don't ask. If they want to, fine. But you can't say that they're obligated. Because that's not their duty. So the point to engage in Krishna's service is what's your duty. Does that make sense? Like the brahmachari, he doesn't have an obligation to engage women in Krishna's service. The grihastha does. Does that make some sense? So just one has to distinguish these things. It can be done. It's not a problem. You know, it's like India doesn't have a problem. The West gets all bajiggity about it. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? You go to a temple in India, you know, and there's a line. It's just all the apsaras and all that. Nobody cares. Like that. You know, you're not going to go to a church and find that. You know what I'm saying? So, Vedic culture doesn't have a problem with that. The girl wants to do that, that's fine. But what I'm saying is you can't oblige a girl to do that. That's my point. That's what I was saying before, is that you have to know what the duties are, and only according to the duties, then there's obligation. So, you know, does that make sense? So a girl, though she knows Bharatanatyam or other kinds of talents like that, she is not obliged to share them in public. Nobody has the right to say she must do that. But if she wants to, it's not a problem, as long as she follows the etiquette and culture and deals nicely. Does that make sense? So that's my point, was you have to distinguish between somebody has a skill, but is it your right to say that they're obligated to use that the way you say it's to be used?
Like that they're being a miser by keeping it in.
Yeah. That's the point. So it has to be something that is shareable. That's what I meant. You know what I'm saying? So that's the point, is that one has to be very careful. You know? Because what is occupation, that's one thing. What's within the ashram side, that's another thing. Right? Because then if it's sadhana, that's between them and the Lord. And if it's family, that's between them and their family. So in either of them, where do we have a right? You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? So one has to use one's discrimination there. Because you are dealing with the social platform. Social, it's already been defined. That's why the acharyas, they are these different things. It's not a problem. Yes.
So, then does varna become an obligation if those skills, the extraneous skills that aren't necessarily...
No, but those are arts. Those aren't varna. The 64 arts are on the ashram side, not in the varna side, unless they're particular arts of that varna.
But then is the varna then the obligation to use in the service?
Yes, varna is. But dancing in public is not an occupation for a girl. If it is an occupation for a girl, then it's something she does. But it still has to be up to the standard under the conditions that she's comfortable with. You know what I'm saying? So that's why the cultural elements are also to be appreciated. Right? But one will understand if one understands the principles on which it's based. Because that's how you apply. Because the detail, there's so much detail. Does that make sense? So that's why one has to be very intelligent. That's why it's easier to look at tradition. Because tradition, somebody intelligent already worked it out. You know, somebody intelligent beyond the modes worked it out. Then if we understand it, then the principle and what they're doing, then we can put it together and apply it in our life very nicely. Otherwise, we can out of sentiment do it, which is not bad, because at least we're following. But the problem is we won't get as much benefit, and we may not be able to give it to the next generation because we can't explain it. So the culture is the applied philosophy. You know, in other words, what's to be shared, that's what's shared. You know what I'm saying? So that's the point. And charity, it's not a matter of you say they have to do it, because charity means they're doing it because they want to do it. So if you can inspire them to give in charity, yes. But to demand they give in charity because it's their business. But how is it your business to demand it? Where did that come from? Right? The Kshatriyas can't demand the Vaishyas give in charity. They can inspire them to give in charity. They can demand they give tax. Tax they're obligated because they're getting benefit from the government. But charity, no one can demand you give charity. It doesn't exist. Where does it? You know what I'm saying? So that's the problem, is we'll think, well, this, I want to make a festival, and this one can do this, this can do that and that. And so then I got it all worked out. I got the whole plan. Then I go to them and say, okay, so, you know, since you can do that, you can do this. And it says, well, I don't do that. What do you mean? You're being a mind. You understand? That's why I'm being very, very careful in this. Because otherwise, too many times we have, well, Bhakti Vidhi Purna Swami said, and I'm not willing to work that out. I've had something where one guru who knows another guru who's something to do with their family and connection here in Mayapur, they're asking me to get involved in that, and there's no way I'm going to get involved in that. You know what I'm saying? Because they're saying, well, I said something, and then they took that, and because I said it, and they're following it in the wrong way, out of context, therefore I'm to blame. You know, it's like, we're going to have to be very careful here. Does that make sense? Like that. So we have to be very careful on saying we're deciding that they're obliged. You know what I'm saying? So that's why I'm saying you have to know the culture to know where is the natural obligation. The person's a good cook, they have the facility, there's things there, everybody else is coming and cooking, they can come and cook, that you can say they can do. You know, because sometimes they cook, sometimes they don't. But to share feminine charms in public, that no one can demand. Not even another woman. No one has that authority. You understand? Like that. Yes?
You said something about... I was just wondering what you meant by the duties. What are the duties?
Duties.
Yeah.
It means what Shastra mentions are the natural duties of a particular varna or ashram.
Oh. And sorry, I think I asked...
Manu gives a lot of definition, but Prabhupada in his purports talks about it, but he's taking from there. But Manu's where they're all in one place, so
yeah.
Like that. If you have the stomach for it, then you can get it from there. Means, in other words, if you like law, then Manu's for you. If you don't like law, don't look at it. Like that. You had something in the back?
So how can we trust tradition? Like you're saying...
How can we trust tradition?
Yeah, you're saying that we
but how can you not trust tradition?
Well, we rely on intelligence of people before us, but you also...
Yeah, but you're. But the point is that people before us, their intelligence, they're beyond the modes of nature. We're talking about the sages, the liberated souls. They're the ones that establish tradition. You know what I'm saying? Lord Brahma, he's the one wearing a dhoti. You know, Lord Vishnu, he's wearing a dhoti. You know what I'm saying? The four Kumaras tell Brahma it's not cool to run after your own daughter. These are liberated souls. Right? So we're following the tradition established by them. Vishnu is speaking it to Brahma. Brahma's teaching it to Swayambhuva. Manu, right? He's teaching it to the other brothers. Right? And then Manusamhita is spoken by Bhrigu. Right? Because somebody might say, well, Swayambhuva is a Kshatriya, so what's his business telling us? But Bhrigu, no Brahmin can claim that he's not the top of the pile. Right? Even more than Brihaspati is Bhrigu. The highest line of Brahmins comes in the Bhrigu line, so no one's going to complain. So if Bhrigu said it, everybody has to buy it. Does that make sense? So the tradition is coming down from the sages. People will, unscrupulous kind of thought patterns will be there that you try to bring that tradition down into the mundane plane. That's just India. So just in India, that's the customs there, but you know, in Europe it's different, and over here it's different. But it doesn't work like that. No, the tradition that is the Shastra's talking about, that's coming from these great liberated souls. You know, if you look, the Smriti, it's, you know, Shiva speaking to Narad, Shiva speaking to this one, the Kumaras are speaking to that one. That's Smriti. So how they practice it, that's what tradition is. Then within tradition, then the acharyas give us direction how to apply that in our situation. Right? Does that make sense? So that's the process. Then you see how to apply that in my personal life. Then that's complete. Is that okay? Yes.
Tradition is an aspect of culture, or are they synonymous, or what's the relationship?
It means the culture that's coming from these great personalities, that's the culture that is, you know, beyond the modes. So that's your best culture, right? It means, because otherwise, you know, you go to Borneo, they got a culture there, you know. So the point is, but it's coming from these liberated souls. So what tradition is what works for the particular culture, what works within that framework, that's tradition, right? It's practical. Tradition's always practical. If you don't understand it, you may not see its practicalness, but it's practical. That's why people do it. So the great personalities that are beyond the modes of nature, what is their practice and therefore their tradition, that's the tradition that therefore the followers of the Vedic culture accept. Does that make sense? That's the idea.
So
right?
Yes. Culture is something broader and tradition more specific.
No, the Veda is what's broader, and tradition is how the great sages follow the Veda. You understand?
So culture and tradition is kind of synonymous.
Culture and tradition, yes. Because others are derivatives of that. You know what I'm saying? You know, it's like in the tradition, then the boy is there, the girl comes out, she goes around the boy 7 times, they exchange flower garlands. You know, this is the preliminaries. It's not the marriage, this is the preliminaries. You know, but I think, I'm not sure where it is, I think in Papua New Guinea, then the night before the wedding, the boy and girl can sit next to each other, but they can only touch the tops of their heads. They can't touch anything else. Right, so you see them sitting there with their heads touching, you know, and they're very happy, right? You know, so the concept of that preliminaries that are there that bring out that kind of, you know, feeling, the romantic element and that concept of that togetherness, that's the Vedic principle. But how the sages do it, you know, with a nice garland and dressed nicely, they don't sit around there touching the top of heads. That's, you know, goes on over there, and they, you know, they're cool. does that make sense? You know, but you go over to the next Aboriginals, they'll say that's stupid. You know what I'm saying? So the point is they're only derivatives based on the same principle, but now they have the manifestation of it. The object isn't what's ideal. It's not what the sages would recommend. Therefore, it comes out looking different. Does that make sense? So that's the whole idea, is to understand what the mechanics of what's going on. Then the whole thing becomes very easy. The problem is, if we don't understand the principles on which it's based, then it's one detail fighting against another detail, and it's always a problem. You know what I'm saying? Like that. But if you understand the principle, you can see it's actually, there's the same thing. Now the point is, what applies to the situation we're in? Right? And does the original context of it, can that be applied here? You know what I'm saying? You know, if it can, great. If it can't, then what's the next best? What's the next best? What's the next? You don't drop from first class to 10th class. You know, from first to second, second to third, third to fourth, until what is ever available and everything like that. You don't buy your own conditioning. Well, we generally do it this way. You know, so therefore you just automatically drop to that. You know, you use what is coming in the line from the great personalities. Because it has, the philosophy and all that's connected. Like if you read the verses of the Vedic marriage ceremony, they're all really, really esoteric, you know, this spiritual mantras. But if you don't know the philosophy, you'll think they're really mundane. like that. But there, you know, the what the second canto of Bhagavatam, you know, is describing and the technicality. That's what all the mantras mean. They're all the beginning mantras are like that. And then you have to understand the context of the social, so that you understand what is the meaning of the later mantras. Does that make sense? So, means you could give a whole presentation on the philosophy just taking the mantras from the wedding, right? If you understand what they mean. Does that make sense? Yeah, so that's the thing, is that the Vedic culture and the philosophy, it matches very nicely. But we'll say, oh, this ritual, you know, I'd rather do it like this. You know what I'm saying? But the thing is these are there because these are all the elements within marriage to consider. Like that. Does that make sense? So that's why the tradition is there. Because this is how the great personalities have applied it. Does that make sense? Yes.
Is culture defined, like, broadly as just the entirety of all human behavior, interactions?
No, culture is defined by what the great personalities do. The other is just subsections of that. Is a skateboard a vehicle? You understand? It has that element, but is that a real vehicle? You know what I'm saying? The kid's going down the street, standing on a skateboard, and the dog's there and dragging him down the street. You know, so by all definition, you know, it's transporting from one place to another. But is that a real vehicle? No, so the point is there is the Vedic culture, then everything else is a derivative of that. But we always like to put everything equal and go, well, there's this and that, so it's all the same, so it doesn't matter. Because if it's all the same, then that means I can do whatever I want. But if it's no, the Vedic culture is the standard, that means I can't just do what I want. I have to follow authority. I don't like that. That's the bottom line. Okay, so
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Jai Srila Prabhupada ki,
Jai
Samaveta Bhaktivinoda ki,
Jai
Jainatai Gaura Premi.